A war of words breaks out between the Pope and the President this week, right on the eve of Leo's historic visit to Africa. The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal, are here with analysis. And he's the chief Washington correspondent for Newsmax. James Rosen is here with his latest book on the late Justice Antonin Scalia and his glory years on the nation's high court. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we celebrate our 30th year. We have a great show for you this evening. If you'd like to send us an X post, if you've got a question, I'm at Raymond Arroyo, and you can always find us at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Over these past several weeks, we've witnessed the most sustained public clash between a sitting American president and a reigning pontiff in memory. Just as Leo XIV embarks on his 10-day apostolic journey to Africa. Here with analysis is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Before we get into this back and forth, Bob, I want to start with you. In modern memory, in your memory, have we ever seen a public spat like this between a pope and a president?
No, I think it's utterly unprecedented. You know, even if there have been differences between the United States and the papacy, and there were during the Cold War, at least before John Paul II arrived in Rome, there was what was called Ostpolitik in Vatican, in the Vatican, which was very conciliatory toward communism. But usually that, if there was a difference, it took place behind closed doors. There was a public a kind of presentation of everyone being respectful. This was just an explosion, and I think it's without precedent, probably in the whole history of the United States.
Yeah, well, following a very tendential piece on 60 Minutes, which featured Cardinal Supich, Cardinal McElroy, and Tobin, Trump unloaded not on the cardinals, but on the Pope, who I think he conflated with those cardinals' opinions of his administration and its policies. And he called the Pope very weak on crime, among other things. The president of the U.S. Bishops' Conference came to the Pope's defense. Archbishop Paul Coakley of Oklahoma City wrote, "I am disheartened that the president chose to write such disparaging words about the Holy Father. Pope Leo is not his rival, nor is the Pope a politician. He is the vicar of Christ who speaks for the truth of the gospel and for the care of souls." Father, Trump has been one of the most Catholic-friendly presidents in modern history. I mean, you have to objectively say he's responsible for overturning Roe v. Wade, or at least laying the groundwork for it. He defended religious liberty and continues to do so. How deep is this rift in the relationship between the church and the White House, in your estimation?
Well, it's certainly a rift between, you know, President Trump's White House and the pontiff, but you know, the Catholic Church in the United States and the interests of the American government coincide in so many ways. And you mentioned the abortion thing. If President Trump is responsible for the nomination of the Supreme Court of the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade. And unlike President Biden, President Trump has defended religious liberty. And we're seeing now revelations of the abuses by the Department of Justice to go after pro-lifers. So there's a lot in common that we share to try and protect religious liberty and freedom. But unfortunately, and I agree with Archbishop Coakley, this is completely uncalled for. President Trump does have a mercurial personality when it comes to dealing with world leaders. You know, he issued disparaging remarks recently about Giorgia Meloni in Italy, the Prime Minister of Spain, the President of France. He's gone after Prime Minister Starmer in England. So I think he's in the mindset that world leaders have to fall in line with him, otherwise he's going to berate them. But the Pope is the vicar of Christ, the successor of Peter. He should not attack the religious leader of the Catholic Church simply because that leader does not agree with many of the things that President Trump is doing. He's got to learn to just sit there, smile, and take it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as we got into on the prayerful posse over on Arroyo Grande this week, and we do a deep dive into this, there is a media layer to this story. There is also possibly a partisan political operation at play under the surface that is driving and pushing this narrative. I see it, you know, I'm watching PBS last night, I'm watching CNN last night, and they're featuring people who are just adding fuel to the fire, and I think, in my estimation, trying to position the Holy Father's comments as partisan or political in nature, which they may or may not be. But let's get into this. The Holy Father stood at the altar on Palm Sunday, and he called on warring parties, really all governments, to, quote, lay down arms, which raises an essential question. What about an unjust aggressor who has pledged to destroy a nation or maybe on the verge of developing or using a nuclear weapon? Bob, does the Pope's formulation, as morally admirable as it is, does it hold up against the specific facts on the ground in Iran in that case?
Yeah, I think myself, this is only my own view, but I think at this point to just lay down arms would be a big mistake, because we have been able to at least curtail the Islamic Republic, as Iran is called, to a large degree. And it is a radical and very nasty and aggressive force, not only in the Middle East, but wherever it can display terror or, you know, induce anti-American activities. I mean, they call us the Great Satan, and they call Israel Little Satan. Mm. That said, though, I have to go back to what we said just before about the Pope. The Pope actually went out and talked about encouraging Catholics to go and talk with their legislators about promoting peace. Now, you know, in a way, at a very high level of abstraction, I think that's okay. Popes are always going to call for peace and for negotiation rather than arms. But this is the one place in this unfortunate back and forth that it seemed to me that he may have made a misstep, because that's stepping outside of his role at saying what ought to be morally, mm-hmm. spiritually, etc., and making specific political recommendations. So, look, there's much yet to be sorted out here, and let's hope that it happens soon.
Yeah, and Bob is referencing when the Pope had his press gaggle outside of Castel Gandolfo, and he said, call your congressmen, call your legislators, tell them to come down on the side of peace and against this war. Well, that is taking a partisan side, and that's not just laying out a moral principle, and I think that's where a lot of the cross wires have been happening. It's the missteps and the overcorrections, I think, in this back and forth that have led to the moment that we're at now, where the media is just having a heyday. We have to address this question, Father, of just war theory, because I think it's at the heart of everything, and Catholics deserve clarity. The Catechism lays out the criteria: grave and lasting damage by an aggressor, last resort, reasonable chance of success, no greater evil produced after the war than what you're trying to prevent. And the USCCB issued a clarification on just war theory this week. Now, this came from the Doctrinal Committee. The entire USCCB did not vote on this. The Doctrinal Committee released this. They say, for over 1,000 years, the Catholic Church has taught just war theory, and it is that long tradition the Holy Father carefully references in his comments on war. A constant tenet of that 1,000-year tradition is a nation can only legitimately take up the sword in self-defense once all peace efforts have failed. That's a quote from the Catechism. That is, to be a just war, it must be a defense against another who actively wages war, which is what the Holy Father actually said. He does not listen to the prayers of those who wage war. When Pope Leo XIV speaks as Supreme Pastor of the Universal Church, he's not merely offering opinions on theology, he is preaching the gospel and exercising his ministry as the Vicar of Christ. Father, does the Iran war, as it has unfolded, the 3,000-plus casualties, the Strait of Hormuz essentially closed, the tens of thousands of Iranian citizens killed in protest, does it check those boxes for a just war?
Well, I believe that this is a just war precisely because of the nature of the threat that a nuclear-armed Iran poses to the United States, Israel, and her allies. And the just war criteria, in my opinion, does not require that we first absorb a nuclear attack before we can actually then respond to try to destroy their nuclear weapons. I think responsible action requires that once we're sure that the Iranians are close to the development of a nuclear weapon. And by the way, for years they told us that's not what they were doing. But then apparently they said to the negotiators, Witkoff and Kushner, that they had enough material to make 11 bombs. And when Vice President Vance in those negotiations last week said, we will require you to stop your nuclear program and to surrender your nuclear material, the Iranians said no. So Iran is a threat precisely because a nuclear-armed Iran is capable of doing tremendous harm to Israel, United States, and her allies making use of such weapons. And that's not a risk that we, the American government, can take. So I think it's a defensive action to prevent the acquisition of a nuclear bomb. You know, just war theory originated in the era of bows, arrows, spears, and the like. Now we have to deal with the fact that the mere possession of nuclear material close to bomb stage, that's an aggressive act by an opponent who has told us all along they weren't going to do it, and they are doing it. So I believe it satisfied the criteria.
Well, look, I've said this before. We've said this before. There is information, there's intelligence, and there's national security threat assessments that the president has at his disposal that the Pope doesn't have. At the same time, there is the depth of Catholic moral teaching that the Pope has on his desk and in his purview that the president lacks. And I worry when they start preaching at each other about things beyond their charism, you get to the state of affairs where we're at. And the average Catholic sitting at home watching a 30-second soundbite on this can't frankly decipher it all. And it looks like the president beating up on the Pope or vice versa. It's bad for everybody. On April 14th, President Trump added to his social media conversation that he's been having with Pope Leo, and he said the following: will someone please tell Pope Leo that Iran has killed at least 42,000 innocent, completely unarmed protesters in the last 2 months, and that for Iran to have a nuclear bomb is absolutely unacceptable? Thank you for your attention to this matter. Bob, does the Pope's broader point hold, that despite any harm done by Iran, this joint U.S.-Israeli conflict has produced evils disproportionate to the threat?
No, I don't think so at all. And I regret that the president took this kind of dismissive tone as if the Pope doesn't already know how awful a regime Iran is. And I think that's pretty well understood in the Vatican. I think Father has raised the main point that, as I've said often, many things in modern technologies place a strain on our Catholic moral tradition. Mm-hmm. And it's not only about nuclear weapons, it's in the biomedical field and elsewhere. But the main point here, and I think it's one that the Vatican is going to have to come to grips with, is that nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, even biological weapons and chemical weapons, these have changed the calculation. You can't allow a rogue regime to have any of these things because of the destruction. Look, there was a war between Iraq and Iran several years ago, and a million people died even just using conventional weapons. So, whatever has happened now is regrettable. Could it have been done a different way? Of course it could. But at some point, a responsible person is going to have to make a decision about where things stand. I wish we had more information from our own administration in the United States, and maybe that will be forthcoming. I have a feeling that we'll be debating whether that material, whether that those facts are sufficient to justify what's happening. But at least we can see that there was potentiality of a threat here, and somebody has to decide at what point to address it. Do we wait until they have the bomb, or that they're going to use it, or they threaten to use it? I think all of that has to be factored into how we consider a move against a regime that has shown itself to be a terror regime. Mm.
Father, today in Cameroon, the Pope said the following. We'll play this for you.
Jesus told us, "Blessed are the peacemakers. But woe to those who manipulate religion in the very name of God for their own military, economic, or political gain, dragging that which is sacred into darkness and filth."
Father, you know how this line is going to be used across the media and played by partisans here in the U.S. I think that he may have been pointedly addressing the Islamic-inspired horrors unfolding in Africa. Your thoughts?
Well, certainly, I agree with the Pope that those who use religion to justify immoral violence through aggressive warfare against innocent people, that's wrong. And that's what we've been hearing from the ISIS and Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah and Hamas. They all justify their violence by saying that this is in fulfillment of their religious duties. And that's wrong. That cannot be used. On the other hand, is it possible to justify just war on the basis of divine principles? In other words, that the moral law teaches you must love your neighbor and defend the innocent. Mm-hmm. And people say it's a godly thing to defend the innocent, and therefore taking up arms to do it when the innocent are threatened with death by an evil aggressor, that's a good thing, and it should be recognized as such. You know, I served as a Navy chaplain, and I saw the dedication of our sailors and Marines, and I understand precisely why they're there. They're there not because they look forward to killing people and hating the enemy. They're there because they love their country, they love their families, they love their neighbors, and they want to protect them against people such as, and we can clearly say, the Iranian regime, which has, as Bob and others have been pointing out, you, Raymond, they've been waging this war for 47 years, killing Americans at many, many places. Horrendous, horrendous terrorist regime.
Yeah. Well, there is a danger, I think, for the, and I've heard from a lot of servicemen over the last few weeks since we've been covering this story. And these are, some of these guys are serving in the field, gentlemen and viewers. And they're Catholic. They're dedicated to their country and their faith. And they are, they feel at sea here because, in their estimation, in some of their letters, they say, we feel like the hierarchy is totally abandoning us, like we're the bad guys. Is there a danger here, Bob, in the in this back and forth, that you lose deeply committed Catholics who, by the way, constitute a hefty part of military and law enforcement across the United States?
Yeah, and that's always, of course, been the case in recent years in America. Yeah, and unfortunately, it does put our sailors, our soldiers, our Navy into all kinds of moral problems that they're really not in a position to resolve. I mean, all they know is what their superiors are telling them. And it's true. I'm glad you raised this point, Raymond, that the Pope, although it may be that his words will be twisted to make it look like he's talking about the United States. When he's talking about a religious justification, and you know, there have been unfortunately some remarks within the Trump administration that kind of pointed in that direction. But in Cameroon in particular, I happen to know this because I've been studying, you know, martyrs recently, as mm-hmm. you know, there is the same kind of radical Islam that exists in Nigeria has moved into northeastern Cameroon. Now, there's an indigenous mm-hmm. English-speaking conflict, and that's another part of it. But that is not predicated on religion. So what Leo was talking about was something entirely different. What you see in Cameroon in terms, I mean, specifically now just in Cameroon, about the use of religion to wage war is Boko Haram, the Islamic State in Western Africa, the very same things, the very same groups that we see trying to create a caliphate in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan. I mean, Cameroon is a little-known country. Mm. But if he was talking about religious justifications for illegitimate use of violence, that, I think, in Cameroon is what he must have been pointing at.
Yeah, well, look, I don't know why the Pope isn't in Nigeria, frankly. I mean, of all the countries he should have gone to in Africa, Nigeria is the one bleeding the heaviest and in most need of papal air cover, if you will. But it seems those comments were directed toward the bloody edges of Islam, as we've often reported on in this show. But I can promise you, tonight and tomorrow and through the weekend, those comments will be used to make it seem as if the Pope is talking about Donald Trump. Watch. Anyway, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson responded to the Pope Leo, President Trump imbroglio this way.
Any religious leader can say anything they want, but obviously if you wade into political waters, I think you should expect some political response.
Father, does the speaker have a point here, or is he misinterpreting Leo's pastoral message?
Well, the point he's making is what diplomats are very conscious of, that when they're discussing conflictual situations or conflicting interests, you always try to use language which is respectful to the dialogue partner, while at the other time making your point in a way that is useful. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a certain amount of diplomatic language that has to be used between the Holy See and various governments. On the other hand, President Trump has to recognize if the Pope preaches the gospel and says things that the president doesn't agree with, well, he's just got to have to sit there and say, okay, he's a religious leader, he's doing his duty, I'm going to be respectful to that. President Trump can say it's not going to influence the way I act. And I would say to the president, well, be careful, because a lot of what the Pope says is good. You don't have to agree with his point, lay down arms. I agree with Bob. That would be a disaster right now. You know, leaving the nuclear material in the possession of the Iranian regime, that was the purpose of this war. And, you know, not to pursue that end to the end, I think would be viewed as a defeat and certainly a strengthening of the Islamic regime. So, yeah, it's always complicated, but the President of the United States has to realize his words carry a lot of influence. He should not go after the Pope in the way he did. If he disagrees, send him a memo, be respectful, but don't attack him and say, the only reason you're Pope is because I got elected, and then the Cardinals chose you to Pope me. It's nonsense.
And Bob, there is that tension there between Archbishop Coakley said, no, this is the Pope expressing the gospel as is his prerogative as the vicar of Christ. Yes, but he's also giving his opinion at a press scrum on his way out of Castel Gandolfo, and it did sound like lobbying when you say, hey, call your congressman, call your representatives, tell them this. That's a personal opinion. That's not ex cathedra teaching, Bob.
Yeah, one of my worries about this is, when a pope speaks, he is speaking out of the tradition of the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
So, Leo has talked about abortion, for example. He's talked about the horrors of abortion, which I assume is something that President Trump applauds, because he himself has been trying to restrict abortion in the United States. But he's not speaking there as a politician. He's speaking as an authoritative voice of Catholicism. But here's where the thing gets dicey, because in a circumstance like this particular war, what can from the Pope's mouth be the expression of a theological or moral theology is read in the secular sphere as a political position.
Intervention,
And just because it has a political dimension doesn't necessarily mean it's political. But as I said earlier, I really think that, the Pope has not even been Pope for a year. I think that he made a mistake with that lobbying question, because that really does step over the line. I hope that in the future there's going to be a maturing of understanding how you handle these things. And some things are not worth trying to fight out in public. Mm.
Meanwhile, the Holy Father is on the road in Africa, as we've been reporting. This is a 10-day apostolic journey through African nations, Algeria and Cameroon, Angola, Equatorial Guinea. This is a continent where the church is exploding. Africa's population is expected to reach 2.5 billion people by 2050, and the church is growing with it. I want to focus on the Algerian stop for a moment because it's loaded with symbolism. Leo visited the great mosque in Algiers, and he had this to say on the papal plane to Cameroon after that visit.
I think the visit to the mosque was significant to say that although we have different beliefs, we have different ways of worshiping, we have different ways of living, we can live together in peace.
Father, your reaction to that, and how does that fit in the backdrop of this Iranian conflict that the world finds itself in?
Well, Christians and Muslims can live in peace. But the primary problem in the actual situation of the world is Muslim fanatics are attacking Christians all over the place. And they're also attacking Jews. And they're attacking people in other religions. You know, we saw ISIS and the evils they did against Yazidis and people like that, other religions, break off groups from Islam. So the main problem in the world today is not Christian violence directed against Muslims. That occurs occasionally, usually in response to attacks. But the main problem is in the Islamic world, the fanatical Islamic kind of groups like the Islamic Republic of Iran, for instance, they use terrorism as a way to what they hope will be subjugate the people they don't like, Christians and Jews. So, the hope for peace is good and we should preach it. But, the moderate voices in Islam throughout the world are not setting the agenda for the common experience of Christians who live in Muslim lands.
And there is that. Again, Bob, this is the tension and the difficulty of the Vatican's foreign policy posture, because they're saying dialogue will cure all ills. How do you dialogue with a group that is blowing people up and slitting throats all over the world in the name of God? How do you do that? And it seems to me, I know it's easy to critique Trump, because he's not going to blow up your church next weekend. It's harder to critique Islam, and I guess easier to walk into the mosque and, you know, face east.
Yeah, you know, the asymmetry here is just incredible, because it's quite true that the greatest religious violence that occurs in the world these days is radical Islam attacking other religions. Mm-hmm. So I wish that it were possible for the Vatican to speak out more directly. The Pope did speak out about the 18 martyrs in Algeria that have been killed since about the 1990s, I think, these 18, including those seven Trappists who were beheaded in that famous incident in Tibereen. But look, I just spoke with a woman of Turkish background who I think has converted to Christianity this past week. And she's an expert on what happens to Christians inside of Islamic countries. And she told me that over 50 churches in Algeria alone have been shuttered in the past few years. And there also is pressure put on even, you know, trying to have prayers in places that the government doesn't want you to have. I asked her whether, you know, it was possible to have regular services inside that beautiful church in Algiers itself. She wasn't exactly sure about that. So whatever kind of live and let live the Pope is trying to promote, if we were really going to be truthful about this, we would have to turn to the other guys and say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we're willing to live with you. Are you willing to live with us? Because from what we can see, maybe not all of you are as radical as these guys that are now coming out in various countries, but it seems like your faith, and I will hear a Pope say this, but the faith going all the way back to Muhammad, who was himself a warlord, who conquered, you know, various cities in the course of developing Islam, it's a very different kind of religion than Christianity. And I think the jury is out about whether those particular two religions can live and let live.
Well, I have to say, the last pontiff who spoke authoritatively and clearly on this was Pope Benedict. And you remember the hell he caught for speaking so forthrightly about the sword of Islam and the only innovations Islam ever gave us, you know, we're deadly ones. Those are hard truths to lay down. One hopes the Pope will do that in a gentle way, but find a way to do that in days ahead. Gentlemen, before we run out of time, I have to bring to everybody's attention a story unfolding in the Southern District of New York. The Dominican Sisters of Hawthorne, they run a nursing facility called Rosary Hill Home in Westchester County. Father Murray's very familiar with it. They've been serving the poor and dying for over 100 years, with complaints. Now, the state of New York is threatening them with fines, license revocation, and potentially imprisonment if they don't comply with a law that requires them to use residents' preferred pronouns and assign rooms based on gender identity. They want the sisters to undergo mandatory cultural competency training in gender ideology. The sisters filed a suit on April 7th. Father, what is the law actually requiring of these women? And why aren't their religious conscientious objections being respected, as are other groups in New York?
Yeah, this is further harassment. It is disgusting that the state of New York would use their bureaucratic hammer to attack nuns who are caring for cancer victims. You know, this is ridiculous. Again, it's the sensitivity crowd. They demand that you be sensitive to them, and they are completely insensitive to anything you do. I applaud those sisters. Can you imagine that nuns who are taking care of people who are dying of cancer, they are being told, you've got to go basically undergo brainwashing so that we can convince you that a man who pretends to be a woman should be admitted into the female bathroom and showers at your facility. This is absurd. It's pathetic that the governor of New York, who is a Catholic, would countenance the bureaucracy doing anything like this. I mean, we already won in the Supreme Court about the contraceptive mandate. They're just trying to relitigate that whole thing now on a state level. This case should be the nuns should be given immediate relief from the courts about this, and then the case should be dismissed, and the procedures being carried out by the bureaucracy have to be outlawed, because it is a horrendous violation of religious liberty.
Yeah, Bob, the wacky thing here, the New York governor, Kathy Hochul, who Father just mentioned, she's a Catholic. That's who signed this into law. And the law contains an exemption for the Church of Christ Scientists because their faith involves healing through prayer alone. But these Catholic sisters who've cared for these indigent dying for a century are given no exemption. What does it tell you about the state of religious freedom in 2026 in New York? And where do you think this will end up should it go to the Supreme Court?
Well, I'm pretty confident that once it goes to the court, the religious liberty of those sisters is going to be upheld because it's traditionally, I mean, very often and these are 9-0 votes because
right.
people at that level recognize what's going to happen if you begin to hinder one religion from saying something. But I want to point to the fact that this is an anti-Catholic thing. At least that's the way it seems to me. I grew up in Connecticut, near New York. I don't know it as well as Father does. I've been living in the D.C. area for many years now. But it always strikes me that you don't see, for example, the state of New York going after Muslims. I have no doubt that Muslims say all sorts of things about homosexuals and abortion and whatever else they believe that's similar to what Catholics believe. But do they ever find the state of New York coming down on them? Of course it wouldn't.
Yeah.
And there are even some Protestant denominations that would agree with us on some of these issues. So the attack on the Catholic Church, I think, is in some ways a badge of honor because they know that we are the ones who are still the bearers of the classical moral and religious tradition in the West. And it's no surprise that it's the Little Sisters of the Poor or, you know, various other organizations that around the edges, they keep trying to hem us in. But thank God for our Supreme Court up until this point. I mean, the particular configuration it has in these days, it seems to be very strongly in favor of protecting the religious liberty of all groups.
Well, gentlemen, we will leave it there for the moment, and we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court in our next segment, but be sure to check out this week's Prayerful Posse episode on Arroyo Grande at YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. We do a deep dive into this Pope versus President imbroglio. Robert Royal, Father Gerald Murray, thank you both for being here. We'll talk to you soon. I can hardly believe that this April 20th will mark the 103rd anniversary of the birth of our beloved Reverend Mother Angelica. Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I recently shared a story few of you have heard. Mother's final 15 years spent largely in silence, suffering, and total surrender. This was the hidden mission of the woman who founded and, I believe, sustained EWTN for so many years. I want to consider Mother Angelica's last years and legacy. Legacies are hard things because they're movable and changing. They're dependent on others. A life is more fixed. So let's start there. Pain, in an odd way, led Rita Rizzo, a young girl who grew up in Canton, Ohio, down the paths God would have her travel. Stomach problems and swollen knees as a nun, shattered vertebra in her back, asthma. These unwelcome surprises, these sufferings, became signs and heralds of the life Mother Angelica was meant to live. They redirected her story that would really be hers alone. She was radically dependent on God's divine providence. That's the trust that God does indeed care for everything. After building her network, the last stage of her life really began in 2001. On Christmas Eve of that year, Mother went to pray in her chapel and she had a major stroke. It greatly limited her speech and certainly hampered her mobility. She was now largely confined to the corner room of Our Lady of the Angels Monastery in Hanceville, Alabama. She would remain in that room exclusively for the better part of 13 years. Most thought her story was over. Let me tell you, they were wrong. The full Arroyo Grande episode featuring the passion of Mother Angelica is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, or iHeart. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss an Arroyo Grande episode. And of course, it's free. Be on the lookout Friday for a new Arroyo Grande. I'll interview Gone Girl author Gillian Flynn. It's a great interview. Go to Arroyo Grande Show wherever you get your podcasts. When he's not busy as chief Washington correspondent at Newsmax, my next guest is a celebrated author, and tonight he's here to talk about volume 2 of his extensive biography of one of the most influential legal minds in U.S. history, the late Justice Antonin Scalia. It's titled Scalia, Supreme Court Years 1986 to 2001. Please welcome back to the program, James Rose. And James, thanks for coming. And you were here for Volume 1.
Yes.
I had to have you back for Volume 2. Now, I got to get, before we get to Scalia, I need to talk about some breaking stories at the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Justice Sonia Sotomayor went before students at the University of Kansas Law School on April 7th. And she essentially suggested, without naming him, that Justice Brett Kavanaugh's concurrence in an immigration case showed he was a man insulated by privilege who couldn't possibly understand what these immigrant stops meant to people like her, Latinas, Latinos like her. On April 15th, she issued this formal apology. "I regret my hurtful comments. I have apologized to my colleague." What does it tell us about the state of the institution, James Rosen, that you have a sitting justice having to apologize to another, and how politics is and identity has gotten in the middle of all this?
Well, you're, first of all, I'm so blessed to be back with you, and thank you for having me back, Raymond. I interviewed Justice Sotomayor way back when she was a district judge in the Bronx in 1998, when I was working for News 12, the Bronx, and she had just been nominated to the appellate bench on her way eventually to the Supreme Court. And I think what this shows us is two things. Number one is justices are more public-facing than they ever were before. They do more university events like the one where she got herself in trouble. They do more TV interviews. They sell books and things. And so to some extent, these things are going to happen when you're out there a lot and you're speaking extemporaneously.
Yeah.
And also speaking about cases, which generally they used to not do. What I think this also shows us, again, is the not just an ideological but a jurisprudential divide on the Supreme Court, which is to say the distinction really is not just between conservative and liberal justices. It's between justices who venerate the original meaning of the Constitution and don't want to see latter-day judges or justices interpreting these legal documents more expansively so they can graft their policy preferences onto the enduring text. It's between original meaning judges and justices and living constitution ones who think the meaning should be allowed to expand like an accordion or what have you. And here in this controversy between Justices Kavanaugh and Sotomayor, Justice Sotomayor's statement that got her in trouble was one where she was faulting her colleague for being insufficiently empathetic to a certain class of people. And it is not the job of any judge or justice to be empathetic or not empathetic. It's only to interpret the law according to the meaning that that law had when it was enacted. You know, you can have a very unempathetic judge who does a very good job of interpreting the law. And Justice Sotomayor's apology, I think, was appropriate. She called her remarks not only hurtful, but she used the word inappropriate. And I think that speaks to her recognition that it's not the job of a justice to display empathy at any given point.
Well, and we're going to get into how Antonin Scalia was so fastidious and particular about his jurisprudence as opposed to his personal belief, even his faith. And
yes.
I want to get to that in a little bit. That's called a cliffhanger. On Fox Business this week, President Trump talked to Maria Bartiromo about the possibility of new appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court, James. He even pointed to how Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death in 2020 affected the balance of the court. Watch.
It could be two, could be three, could be one. I don't know. I'm prepared to do it.
James, Justice Sam Alito was hospitalized briefly last month, and he's already being perceived as doing his farewell moments. He's got a book coming out in October. The president is sending messages maybe here to Alito or possibly Clarence Thomas that it's time to go. But either way, this isn't going to affect the balance of the court. An appointment, a replacement for either one of those gentlemen.
Ideologically speaking, or jurisprudentially correct, the president would nominate candidates who would embody the same approach to the Constitution as Justices Thomas and Alito. So you're right; it wouldn't affect that kind of balance. Where Justice Thomas is concerned, my understanding is that within the duration of this second term of President Trump, I think 2028. Justice Thomas will surpass William O. Douglas as the longest-serving justice in history. And given the ordeal and the very terribly cruel and unfair ordeal that, that Justice Thomas endured to make it onto the court, I think that would be of some importance to him. It would immediately change, I think, every lead written about him when he eventually ascends to the great court in the sky, and to say that, Justice Clarence Thomas, the longest-serving justice in the history of the court, that would be the obligatory first thing that would have to be said about
right.
him. time. And as for Justice Alito, he has resisted any attempts at pressure. But I confirmed with my interviews with that living saint, Maureen Scalia, that that this is important to the justices, who succeeds them. And they do pay attention to the idea of retiring at the right time so as in the case of Justice Ginsburg, you won't see all of your work undone, or when you pass, all of your work will be undone. And in many respects, there are many liberal activists who venerated Justice Ginsburg, but who now regard that she was something of the epitome of selfishness for not choosing the right time to step down.
Well, speaking of Justice Clarence Thomas, who you mentioned a moment ago, he delivered a speech at the University of Texas in Austin this week, marking the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And he warned that progressivism is retrogressive, and it's a threat to American founding principles, natural rights, and limited government, and he urged civic engagement.
I think if we don't stand up and take ownership of our country and take responsible for it, we are slowly letting others control how we think and what we think.
James Scalia was passionately a believer that judges should stay out of the policy arena. Right. Do we have a case here of Clarence Thomas, sort of the last originalist on the court, carrying Nino's torch? Is he sort of eschewing that advice and wandering into the public policy arena here?
I don't see that at all.
No?
I see those remarks as a call to civics and a call to a greater understanding of the founding and the principles of our founding, which is very sorely lacking, unfortunately, particularly in public education today, where it seems that there can't even be a reference to the founders without inserting some parenthetical clause about how flawed though they were. And I think Justice Thomas venerates the founding, and he has always made the case as a legal matter, by the way, that the Declaration of Independence deserves equal consideration with the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as judges and justices make their decisions. Scalia didn't necessarily share that view of the Declaration.
Right. I want to get to Volume 2 of Scalia, which really captures the years 1986 to 2001. In Rise to Greatness, the former book, you spent a lot of time about Justice Scalia's formation, his Jesuit upbringing, Chicago law. Tell me why this second volume? Why break it into volumes, James?
Well, so the first book covered the first 50 years of his life, and it ends with him sitting down in his chair at the Supreme Court. He had a very fascinating career in government, and I was able to gain hold of so many previously unpublished materials, including his own oral history, which had never been published, his papers from the Ford administration, his papers from the Nixon administration. And, I mean, he even turbocharged the digital revolution. He predicted the internet in 1971 in writing. So he had a fascinating career before the court. Then I set about writing Volume 2, in which I would cover the entirety of his 29 and a half terms on the court. And I only got as far as his midpoint, which was the conclusion of Bush v. Gore, before I realized I've written a full-length book. So this is a titanic American life. Antonin Scalia is not just an important Supreme Court justice. He's one of the most important Americans of the last 100 years. And I'd put him up there with any inventor or president of the United States or Babe Ruth or anyone else, because he changed the way the law is drafted, debated, and decided in this country, ushering in that switch from the old living constitutionalist model where anything can be read into a law into a greater adherence up and down throughout the judiciary, including the Supreme Court, on the text of the laws and their original meaning. And that change affects every American alive today.
Do you think that Scalia doctrine, if you will, the originalist reading of the Constitution, that really runs through the great majority of the Supreme Court justices we see now on this court?
Well, you've got a 6-3 supermajority on the court, thanks to in large measure to President Trump. It's not clear that all of those nominees now on the court are at all points observing Scalian originalism.
Yeah.
There has been some.
There have been deviations.
There have been some expressions of discontent from the Scalia faithful with, let's say, his successor, Justice Gorsuch, and also with the one clerk of his who's made it to the court, which is Justice Barrett.
Yeah.
But by and large, I interviewed Justice Alito for this project, and he told me there is a straight line from Scalia's writings in the 70s against abortion, his appearances on PBS debate programs in the 1970s denouncing Roe v. Wade, all the way through Dobbs. And he said to me, it's an originalist opinion, and I flatter myself, Justice Alito said, to think that if Nino had written Dobbs, he'd have written it the way I wrote it.
Wow. Yeah, you do hear shades of Scalia when you read that opinion. I mean, but there was nobody like Scalia. He could dissect and take things apart, and his just the grasp of that mind.
And the wit and the humor.
Yes. And I mean, look, we know his sons, we know his family. Right. There was a personal toll that cost that family for that level of focus.
And renown as well.
Yes. And what would that have been, in your opinion?
It's the shadow is longest for the two lawyers in the family of Gene Scalia and John Scalia.
Yeah.
But, you know, after Bush v. Gore, the country viewed Antonin Scalia very differently and unfairly, and the court itself forever. The views of the court were changed forever after Bush v. Gore. And I've interviewed 7 of the 9 Scalia children, which I consider a decent batting average.
Yeah.
And they told me about how after Bush v. Gore, they would be approached in public places and attacked. And, you know, there was that toll. I did want to make this point. The first book traces the formation of Scalia's faith, okay, as a product of his parents, who were devout Catholics, and also Jesuit schools, and 2 of them in a row. He was the valedictorian. Yeah. Back when Jesuits stood for something very different, I think, than what they do today. This book, Scalia's Supreme Court Years, traces how he strove at all points to keep separate, as you mentioned earlier, the tenets of his Catholic faith and his jurisprudence. Because just as he didn't want latter-day judges and justices grafting their own policy preferences into these expansive readings of enduring texts, he didn't want to graft his Catholicism onto the law, his interpretations of the law. And the way he would put it, Raymond, is he would say, there's no such thing as a Catholic hamburger. The closest we would come is if the hamburger were prepared perfectly.
That's right. Well, I remember him saying, and I remember him saying repeatedly, I do lawyerly analysis, not theology.
Right.
And he was very blunt about that. Give me a sense of how that faith and the legal analysis, how was he able to keep them separated when they were so integral in his personal life?
The irony of this is that, as a legal matter, he did not believe in separation of church and state.
Right.
His view was that the founders never envisioned a complete expungement of faith from the public square. They just didn't want the federal government picking winners and losers amongst different faiths. But in his own life, he maintained this separation of church and state, and fidelity to text really was the means he used.
You had access to internal court correspondence, archival materials that we haven't seen from the Harvard Law School, for instance.
Right.
You mentioned his oral history, which I didn't know existed.
Right.
And I knew Nino Scalia. What surprised you most in the previously unpublished material that you came across? What didn't you expect to find that you did?
That's a tough question. I would love to think about it a little bit more than the dictates of TV provide. In the first book, I think a lot of people were surprised by how frequently he experienced rejection and setbacks on his path to the Supreme Court. And as I say, in the first book showed the formation of the faith. This shows how he treats the faith separate from the jurisprudence. Volume 3 will show the testing of his Catholic faith through some very wounding personal situations that he had to cope with, and heartbreaks of different kinds. But at all points, he maintained that faith. As you surely know, the Scalias had 9 children. When he would meet a congressman who would tell him he had 5 children, Scalia would squint at him and say, respectable. All 9 of those children remain devout Catholics.
Yep.
8 of the 9, with the exception, of course, of Father Paul Scalia, have raised large Catholic families with a minimum of 4 children up to a maximum of 7, producing, I think, a total of 41 grandchildren for Mrs. Scalia, of course, is still with us.
Incredible, yeah. Tell me about the influence of Father Jerome Fasano, who is a friend of mine, and was the pastor and confidant and confessor to the Scalias. He would frequent the home, visit them for dinners. You finally got Father Fasano to sit for an interview. What did he tell you?
Oh, it went for hours. And he's one of a number of priests I've interviewed for this project, including Opus Dei priests with whom Justice Scalia would go on retreats and forth. But Father Fasano was a little bit younger than Justice Scalia, but was also kind of an outer borough Catholic from New York, and they kind of would go back and forth. Father Paul Scalia told me that they would go at it pretty ferociously at Thanksgivings and Easters. He told me, for example, that Scalia in church would sometimes, if there was a crying baby, march right up to the family and rebuke them for not doing a better job of controlling their child. Or he would come to Father Fasano with complaints about the liturgy or the music that the choir director had chosen. And at one point, he needles Justice Scalia. He's about to attend a speech of Scalia's. And like all people who speak for a living, Scalia had different speeches that he would rotate and so forth. And just to sort of have a little fun, Father Fasano says to him, which speech are we going to get tonight, A, B, or C? Oh. Scalia, who had a famous temper,
yes, he did.
And there's a lot about that in this book, explodes at him and says, I've sat in your pews for 20 years. I've seen you repeat sermons. You know, it was sort of like the Sunshine Boys, the two of them, when they would get together, you know, sort of pecking at each other. But there was deep love. This was someone who guided three Scalia boys as altar boys, who performed weddings for the Scalia children, baptisms for the Scalia grandchildren, spent 20 years at Easter and took confession from Justice Scalia.
Yeah.
Obviously, some of this wasn't disclosed to me, of course, properly.
I hope not.
Properly. But but nonetheless, you do get a real insight into the man and the family and the faith this book.
He was a feisty and colorful character. I have to say, Nino would sit in front of me at St. Mary's many years ago here in town. So I'm well acquainted with the, if you were talking before Mass or after Mass, he would turn it, and go back to his prayers. Oh, no. He didn't cross
any. I just want to say very briefly,
There's
a chapter in this book called The Rabbit. And this is the story of my personal one-on-one lunches with Scalia when I was, you know, 30 and 32. This is 1999 and 2001. And our very amusing correspondence. And the record, the contents of the lunches were off the record, so they remain so.
Okay.
But with this dispensation of the Scalia family, which also supplied a lot of previously unpublished photographs for this book, I'm allowed to say a little bit about the lunch. And when I got there, this was his favorite place, the AV Ristorante Italiano, long gone.
Yeah.
And a very modest place with like plastic grapes on the wall and so forth. And I got there first, and when he showed up, he had a kind of Jackie Gleason grandiloquence about him, sharp elbows. And he said to the waiter, who was a young Italian guy, barely spoke English, Pulpy, what is pulpy? And the guy says, octopus. And he says, I'll have the octopus, the pulpy, here you go. And he gives him the menu, you know, the grand flourish. And I knew what I wanted, nothing to eat with my hands, nothing that splatters. I'm from Staten Island, I know Italian food. I said, veal parmesan. The guy, and he's writing it down, and Justice Scalia says, no. Give him the rabbit. And we both look at him and we say, rabbit? And he goes, yeah, he's going to like the rabbit. Give him the rabbit. And the guy walks off. Now, Raymond, I had never had rabbit in my life. I didn't want rabbit. I was grossed out by it. I haven't had rabbit since.
You'll have the rabbit.
But, like, what's most remarkable about this is that here you have the country's foremost opponent of judicial activism overruling my lunch order, which not even Mrs. Rosen does.
Menu activism he was all for. Look, the book is full of moments that really humanize Justice Scalia. He was a great admirer, I learned from this, I didn't know, of Justice Brennan.
Yes.
A man whose jurisprudence he fundamentally opposed. We know he had, and I know this, had a close and regular relationship with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They'd go to opera together. They'd dine together. He embraced Clarence Thomas after what he called a brutal confirmation. What do these associations tell us about how Scalia understood the institution? And more importantly, and I'm thinking of Clarence Thomas, who came up to us at Scalia's funeral and said, with tears in his eyes, I don't know who's going to hold us together now, he told us. And I thought, wow, Scalia was really the glue that held the personal side of the court together.
Well, he had not only his innate genius and his dazzling literary gifts, but he was a very affable guy. And on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, he had relationships with Ruth Bader Ginsburg and other judges who had been appointed by President Carter. By and large, he found it a lot easier to get along with the liberals on the court than with the so-called conservatives, many of whom, such as Sandra Day O'Connor, Tony Kennedy, others, he felt were always placing their finger in the wind to determine what the New York Times would say about their next ruling. The exception being Clarence Thomas, for whom he had real reverence and with whom he had a real deep bond. I interviewed Justice Thomas for this book, and there's stories in here about the two of them sneaking cigarettes in the lawyer's lounge together and breaking away from their marshal teams to go attend mass together near the court. With Justice Brennan, whom you mentioned, who was one of the architects of the Warren Court's revolution of liberal rulings, Scalia had outsized admiration for him. And I consider one of the big revelations in this book is that I went through the papers of Justice Brennan at the Library of Congress and found a previously unpublished letter that he wrote to a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, whom I also interviewed, congratulating him on a very unflattering profile of Scalia, in which he said to this reporter, it says what so many think. Scalia went to his death imagining that he and Brennan were very close, and he called him like an uncle to him. And this was artfully concealed from him, in a sense. And the reporter in question, Paul Barrett, who now teaches at NYU, told me that off the record, Justice Brennan had confided to him very negative views of Justice Scalia and his work, his role on the court.
Wow.
So I think that's one of the revelations of the book.
Wow.
Well, it doesn't matter. Scalia's overshadowed Brennan in many ways, and time, you know, sure. We see the drive, you know, the Brennan legacy fading as the Scalia legacy rises. Yes. By the end of Volume 2, you see Antonin Scalia in near constant dissent, and you depict him that way. He's even considering retirement at one point. Mm-hmm. James, when you look at the court today, what remains of Scalia's legacy, and what does the court lack without him?
Well, look, it's hard to say that the court lacks something without him, because the court has new personalities, and you know, we're all meant for our own time.
Yeah,
in a
but
sense.
There's not a scoutmaster now, James. He was kind of the scoutmaster. They could all congregate around Nino. That's gone. There is nobody doing that now.
But look, Scalia left us a little over 10 years ago in February 2016, a shocking development, even though he was closing in on 80. And in that time, social media was not what it is today. Okay, the entire landscape of American politics and jurisprudence has changed from what it was just 10 years ago. And Justice Alito said this to me. He said, things are so different just since Nino left.
Wow. Yeah, his I'm told personally that he would create events for them. He would have dinners for them. They would plan outings together. There was a camaraderie and a closeness that really they have not had since Nino's departure.
Probably it's safe to say that there has not been, since Justice Scalia passed, anyone on the court who is capable at a moment's notice of commandeering someone's piano and belting out show tunes and Christmas carols. In Volume 1, when he was an assistant attorney general under President Ford in the post-Watergate era, they had the presidential yacht, the Sequoia, which I don't think is in service anymore. We used to be able to pay to get on it and hold events there. And the Department of Justice held a little cocktail evening on the Sequoia for the assistant attorneys general, the deputy attorney general, and so forth, and their dates. And Stan Pottinger, who was another member of the Department of Justice, an assistant attorney general at that time, brought his date. And they all stood around, and as Scalia, at the age of 39, was banging away on the piano on the Sequoia and leading everyone in song, Stan Pottinger's date was Gloria Steinem.
Wow. Now
so
that's a...
Gloria Steinem was entertained by Antonin Scalia.
And there you sang have. Along with
yes.
him. At least once. I love that you have the picture here of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Nino in the opera at the Kennedy Center, which they frequented and appeared in together at one point. And I can remember them singing. There was some evening, and it was Antonin... it was Bocelli and Placido Domingo. And they did an evening of Neapolitan love songs. And Nino and Maureen were sitting in front of me. And throughout, he kept commenting to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was in my row, about, they really missed that one. That note's a little off. I wish they would redo that. He was commenting as it's happening. He was amazing. Scott, thank you for bringing this story to people and bringing Nino Scalia in a fulsome way, not only his jurisprudence and his great mind, but the man behind the constitutionalist.
And the Catholic.
And the
this book shows that he was both the primary exponent of the law in his time and one of the primary exponents of Catholicism in his time.
And he knew when to keep them apart and when to bring them together. Scalia, the Supreme Court Years, 1986 to 2001, by James Rosen, is available now at bookstores everywhere and online from Regnery. And you can follow James on X at James Rosen TV. James, thank you for
being
here.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you.
See you soon. Thank you. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.